Expert Instruction, the Teach by Design podcast, where we dive deeper into the research surrounding student behavior by talking with the people implementing these practices, where they work, and with the students they support. I'm Megan Cave.
I'm Danielle Triplett. Happy November.
Yeah.
No school November, they say.
So they say. November is the month. We are moving through our theme this school year of data and PBIS. And this month, we transition away from a tier one support and we move into tier two.
Well, and by moving in, we're layering on top of. Right? Yes.
On.
Yes.
As we learned throughout our episode today, we are layering on and we're talking about tier two data. But in order to do that, we really wanted to start by addressing a myth, which is that behavior. I did write this down. Okay. Behaviors in classrooms are more significant than ever.
Yes.
That is the current perception out there. And so we wanted to address that today. We wanted to decide whether we could confirm or bust.
Yeah.
This perception. And if you've had the opportunity to read this month's Teach by Design article, I dove into some data at some tier one data, actually. We produce a summary of referral trends to see just how things are going, taking kind of a quick pulse on how things are going nationally here in the United States.
And yeah, we have access to that data here. That's part of what we do.
I know. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that report has come out. It's very recently produced, so go check it out. But essentially what we've seen is that in the 20 years we've been looking at these data, the trends have gone down, in particular for elementary schools. Mm-hmm. We do have data on middle and high schools, but the trends have gone down. So the number of referrals that are being handed out every day per 100 students in schools across the country has been decreasing, which is excellent, right?
Yep.
This is what we want to see. And then what we have noticed over these last 5-6 years is a steady increase in those trends. And so, I mean, it's a bit of a spoiler alert.
Mm-hmm.
But this myth that we're trying to address, we can't essentially bust it.
No.
Because data are showing us that the behaviors that you're experiencing, or at least the way that you're documenting them, has increased in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to address that today and try and find, instead of spending our time lamenting the behaviors that we see in classrooms, we wanted to spend our time really talking about some solutions.
Totally.
And part of that solution is identifying the ways that we can offer additional support to students and how we can use data to do that.
And to do it within the PBIS framework, which really encourages us to be preventative, proactive, and positive.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we invited our friends, Billy Joe, Dr. Billy Joe Rodriguez and Noah Van Horn, to join us today to talk a little bit more about tier two, but in particular, the ways that data can help us provide that additional support and maybe alleviate some of the behaviors that we see in classrooms all the time. So let me tell you a little bit about our friends, Billy Joe and Noah. Billy Joe is a member of the Northwest PBIS Network. She works with them extensively. She's an associate teaching professor and the school psychology director of clinical training at the University of Oregon. She's a nationally certified school psychologist, a board certified behavior analyst, and she has over 20 years of experience supporting students with diverse needs, helping schools implement increasingly intensive function-based supports. She's a multi-hyphenate, that Billy Joe.
She sure is. She sure is.
And Noah is a nationally certified school psychologist and a PBIS coach for Springfield Public Schools in Springfield, Oregon. In addition to the work that he does leading the district's initiatives to support PBIS, he's also a lead trainer for district professional development on topics ranging from tier one practices to more intensive individualized support. You know Noah very well.
I do. Yes, I sure do. I've worked with him over the course of, probably the last 15 years. And he also works at the Northwest PBIS Network.
Yes.
Really big part of that. I know they've got their conference coming up in the spring.
Yes.
But I've loved working with Noah in particular. Like, I feel like he's just such a wealth of knowledge. And he's the kind of person, we were joking on our team the other day, we're like, we're going to email Noah. And I bet he already will have anticipated that we would ask him that question. Like he's that guy. And it's kind of true. So we're thrilled to chat with them and really raise up their voices for you all today.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's so great about having these episodes and having the opportunity to have these conversations that we have is that we get to spend time with people who are so experienced, who have been doing this work for so long. They have so many stories to tell and little tidbits of information that make it seem so manageable and so doable. And we were able to talk to two of those people. It was really a privilege, and we're so grateful that we get to share the conversation with all of you.
Yes. So listen in. Before we do that, though, I want to give a shout out, because this week, if you're listening live at least this week, we've got two other events happening that are open to everybody. Virtual, there's a webinar on Tier 2 happening on Thursday.
Yep. And it's all about check in, check out, the intervention. So you can learn. If you don't know more, you want to know more, go ahead and come to that.
It's a space to come. We'll be offering professional development and time for discussion and Q&A. And then Friday, we have our community of practice. And it's also focused on Tier 2. We're going to be really exploring some of the same things we talked about on this episode. So,
and it's all free.
It's all free. Yes, your federal tax dollars are our grant hard at work. So we are, we'd love to see you there. Join if you are able.
Yeah, you can sign up on our website. All right, without any further ado, Billy, Joe, and Noah. Thanks so much for joining us today, for agreeing to be with us this November.
Welcome.
We're talking about, we're busting a myth today. But are we?
Well, we're gonna explore it. We're gonna try.
We are.
Holes in this myth.
We are. So our myth this month is behaviors in classrooms are more significant than ever. This is something we've heard from the people that we talk to every day, that we see it online. We see it in news headlines, that classrooms are just a little more escalated in their behaviors now than they have been before. And people are feeling overwhelmed by that.
Yeah. There is this sense, though, that post-pandemic, schools are different. Classrooms are different.
Yeah.
Behaviors are increasing. We do hear this.
Yes, we do.
Nationally.
So we just shared. We shared some trends related to the referral data that are entered into our school-wide information system. Mm-hmm. And we actually do see the trends are moving upwards slightly, but they are moving upwards. And when we're talking about millions of referrals over, 20 years of data.
Right. Across the whole country.
Yeah. Across the country. Those tiny elevations are significant in some ways. And so we wanted to just first kind of talk to you all about the things that you've seen and heard. What are some of the factors that you can see contributing to this upward trend that we're seeing in referral patterns?
I mean, I think this is a complicated question and somewhat loaded because I think there are a lot of variables that contribute to increase in behaviors experienced at school, and especially kind of thinking post the pandemic. And as you all have alluded to, I think some of the things that we see are true elevations in behavior change. Our COVID babies started kindergarten this year. and so some of them, had really different early childhood experiences than babies that were born prior to COVID. And so the skills and the gaps and the lags in terms of their experiences coming into school are significant for, a chunk of children that looks different than pre-pandemic. I also think we've seen increases in things that we know contribute to challenges with regulation, such as screen and device use, and some of the research around the impacts on brain development, and particularly executive functioning type skills and attention type skills. And so, that it's yet to see how all of that plays out, but I think we have kids and maybe adults too who are in schools and experience withdrawal on a fairly regular basis and are used to, those dopamine releases that happen when they're in front of a device, or, lack of access to that to support behavior regulation in a school setting. I also think, at least coming back from the pandemic, we saw adults who were stressed and carrying more stress. And I think that continues still. And so our ability as adults to co-regulate and support calm, nurturing environments with, the stressors that we're carrying impact behavior. And then I don't know about nationally, but I know in Oregon, where I am, class size has also been a really big point of discussion around, how many students are in the shared space together with an adult, and some of the impacts on, how that might impact behavior. I know my own fifth graders in a class of over 30.
Mine too.
So,
Mine too.
So yeah, so that really, you know, changes the stress levels, the energy levels on a lot of accounts. So I also think, at least in a lot of schools that I've worked with, we've gotten better at documenting what's happening. And so we might also be seeing some elevations in data that are not always a function of increased behavior, but actually better task of documenting what's happening. And so our data might also be more reflective of what classrooms have looked like for some time, but now it's kind of starting to catch up with that. So
that's a lot of things. It's Billy Joe. I had several moments when you said the like screen withdrawal. I'm thinking of how what I see in my own family or my, you know, like that makes a lot of sense.
Noah Wales.
Yeah. What do you see?
No, I mean, I feel like Billy Joe just did us all solid service by basically outlining what politicians and educators have been trying to kind of piece together for years now.
Yep.
You know, she was mentioning the screen time side of things and the withdrawal, but I also think in addition to the withdrawal piece, during the pandemic, when you know, we're all trying to work from home and we had to rely on tools like that to kind of keep kids entertained, I remember hearing the Surgeon General warning talking about concerns about how we were going to develop habits during the pandemic that maybe would stick with us. Mm-hmm. And I think that the screen time thing might have been one that, you know, in addition to the increased prevalence, you had kids, and I think about it from the lens of a parent who's got kids in elementary school, but you had kids who were kind of using that as a way to get through the day, but now are very used to that. And then as parents, people became very used to that as well. And so when we think about what was going on in the home and what's happening now, we don't necessarily have the same level of conversation with kids. Kids aren't necessarily outside playing as frequently as maybe they would have before and engaging in some of those social interactions that work as those building blocks for developing the necessary social skills to be able to manage within a school setting. But beyond that, you know, you think about the screens that bigger kids might be accessing and the amount of social media time, right? That leads to what we've seen from research and is decreases in mental health and whatnot. And so when we kind of piece all of those things that Billy Joe so eloquently shared with us together, you can kind of start to get a better picture of just the whole host of factors that took place then that have kind of carried over. And then we think about the things that are happening within, you know, our country over the last year or two or three, and the level of, you know, instability that can be felt in various points across in time and across the country. And so I just feel like if we think about the whole kind of process of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if we're not feeling like everyone's basic needs are being met, it's a lot harder for them to feel regulated at school and to be able to come in ready to learn. So you can see a lot of social environmental factors that might attribute to it. But I do want to echo what she said as well about the referral writing behavior from us as adults. I think that has changed significantly over time. And so as much as I totally agree that there are increases in behavioral issues within schools and that some of those social, emotional, behavioral regulation skills aren't necessarily where we would want them to be, I think there's also adult behavior that has changed within the school setting as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, such excellent points. It's really reminding me, you know, we feel like the pandemic's in the past, and yet thinking about, yeah, the babies that were born in 2020 are now in kindergarten. And of course, that is having an impact. So let's talk about what you all see, because you're out there working with schools. So as you're attending meetings and doing work with educators, tell us what you hear from teachers about what their experiences are like managing behaviors in class. And what have you noticed in those experiences between the pandemic to now?
I think we've seen some changes, some legal changes, again, in Oregon, and I think nationally as well, around educators' responsibilities for supporting kids. And I think those are partly related to, or strongly related to, evidence around the school to prison pipeline, right? And the use of exclusionary practices being, you know, ineffective, and also disproportionate impacts of those types of practices. But I think sometimes those changes have been you know, put on educators without necessarily additional resources, both, you know, fiscal resources as well as skill and knowledge resources. And so I think that's one piece that I hear teachers talking about is just having behaviors that they haven't seen before, or that they that are repeated behaviors that in the past, I think maybe those students would have been asked to leave that learning space. And then, you know, that is not necessarily improving outcomes for that particular student or group of students who are struggling, but does make it easier for teachers to teach, you know, the students who are still in the classroom. And so I think some of the increased expectations for supporting kids with more challenging behavior has been a stressor for our educators. And again, those changes are there because we know what happens if we engage in those exclusionary practices. But I see that as being a pretty common stressor in terms of teacher experience, is frustration with that or lack of skill or knowledge around, you know, how to change that pattern to be more productive, both for the student and the classroom.
Yeah. Totally agree. I and, you know, think about the number of kids that you've got in the classroom. You two were talking earlier about the you know, class size that your kids have. So you've got, you know, potentially increased class sizes or variables like that that are going to contribute to an individual teacher's experience. But then if we think about all of the other things that we talked about in the earlier part, where there are a variety of social variables and whatnot impacting kids coming into school, I feel like there's a little bit of a tipping point part that comes into any given classroom, right? So as a teacher, you might have at one point in time had one or two or three kids that were a little bit more challenging that needed some more support. The just intensity of those might be a little bit more, or the frequency of behaviors might be a little bit more now, or the number of kids that need a little bit more support might be a little bit more now. And so as a teacher, you kind of just hit that tipping point where it feels a whole lot worse sometimes. But then you can also have a teacher right across the hall that has a different classroom makeup and is feeling like this is the best year that they've ever had because just whatever it is that's going on in their classroom. So I don't know. I feel like it's completely varied from teacher to teacher and grade to grade. Even I was in meetings with one of my middle schools, and they were talking about how they just love this sixth grade group that they've got, but their seventh grade group is super hard and challenging. And so they're just watching that wave roll through sixth and seventh, and then next year still trying to plug away at it at eighth grade to make overall shifts at the grade level. And so you just kind of have these little bits of I don't know, behavioral issues that can kind of tip the scales for certain teachers and certain grade levels at any given point in time.
You're reminding me of this comedian who had a bit where he had several children, 5, 6, 7. I can't remember. It was more than three. And someone asked him when they had he and his wife were expecting their third baby. And he asked someone like that did have kids, like, what's it like to have three kids? And he's like, well, it's like you're swimming in a pool and someone throws you a baby. You're just like trying to tread water while holding a baby. And so at some point, it's like you were saying, there's like a tipping point, you know, like I can manage, you know, if I have a two parent household, we each can like divide and conquer. We've got two kids in the house. You have one more kid. Now it feels like you just added five more kids just by adding the one, you know? Yeah. And so I can relate. I think I understand what you're talking about, how it's just like a little bit more until finally it's like, it's too much. There's a tipping point.
What are you going to say, Billy Joe?
You were talking about kind of the differences, or asked the question about between the pandemic and now. And one of the other thoughts that I had just about teacher experiences is I think when the pandemic happened, we really just sort of refocused on, at least I know I was working in Springfield at that time, and it was like relationships, right? We're going to try to connect with people and meet them where they are and make sure they have those basic needs met, like Noah was saying, and any kind of learning that we do academic wise, you know, that we'll figure that out, right? But the emphasis was on relationships. And then I think, you know, we spent, at least in Oregon, quite a bit of time on Zoom and doing Zoom school. And there were all kinds of health and safety protocols and other things that were, you know, needing attention as kids were coming back in person. And for a lot of our schools, that meant that some of the things that had been strong habits around their proactive and preventative instructional design and relationships and PBIS features took a back burner for a few minutes, right? It was like, oh, we got to figure out how to separate these desks and how to do. Yeah. And then some of those things went away. But I think then we had sort of created less proactive habits. Because we didn't do those things for a period of time. Mm. And so having to kind of refocus and be intentional about how we set expectations and reinforce those. I remember even when my daughter, she's 14 now, but when she was 5 or 6, we had done a sticker chart and trying to reinforce, you know, bedtime routine. But at one point I found myself just really engaging in a lot of, you know, if you don't get this done, you're going to lose your time to watch your show or whatever she, and I remember putting her in her bed one evening and thinking, what am I doing? Yeah. You know, I have my PhD in this.
I know.
But the
totally
reactive kind of mode is, I think, natural for us as humans, right? And the proactive piece takes planning. The intervention was actually the same, right? Like, and I could frame it around, you know, when you get these things done, you get to have, you know, yeah, versus you're about to lose. And but what that was doing to our relationship. And so I think in some of that time, kind of returning from the pandemic and trying to find the normal and establish a new normal, some of the habits that had been supporting really successful kid and adult environments, we kind of had to restart those too and figure out what they look like now and what did we used to do. And meanwhile, you know, we've lost some of those habits that maybe were positive and proactive and supportive. And so then we get into firefight mode. Yeah. And then we are in react mode versus the proactive planning mode. And so I think that's a piece of it too, that with lots of conversations with teachers, like, oh yeah, I used to do this thing and that worked really well. And, you know, kind of coming back to some of that has been important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the other part of it too that really hit me as you guys were both talking about it is this idea that teachers maybe don't know what skills they have available to them, mm-hmm. or the resources that they have available to them to support some of these escalated mm-hmm. behaviors that they see in their classrooms, mm-hmm. Or that schools used to do it and they're not doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. So we can't solve a lot of problems out here. But the thing that we do know something about is this PBIS framework, this multi-tiered system. And I think that what can get lost in PBI, the acronym and the PBIS acronym, is the fact that there are multiple tiers to the support that we offer. Mm. And so it can get lost that we're acknowledging behavior, we've got expectations defined, we're documenting the behaviors that we don't want to see, we're doing all of those things. And then that's what PBIS is. But there are additional layers, right? There's mm-hmm. more support we can offer. Yes. So let's talk about, what is that next level? What is tier two? If you can help us just to quickly define, because you guys are both great at it.
But that's what we've noticed too, is yes. as we're talking to educators, tier yep. two is squishy. It, yeah. Not everybody can define it. So we're really looking to, like,
it's hard for people.
Help folks understand
so what it is. So let's make it a little more concrete, yeah. right?
Let's hear it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think as cliche as it might sound, tier two really is about dosing up our tier one, right? And so it's about intensifying the things that we know are effective practices and layering that in a more intentional and strategic way. And so, you know, I think defining something by what it is, also it's helpful to know what it's not, right? And so it has to be efficient, because if we think about, you know, the percentage of students who might have some risk and need some additional supports, we have to be really careful about overly individualizing or innovating too quickly, because that becomes really cumbersome and difficult to support and implement. And it also actually, if we individualize too quickly, is not great for kids, because it's harder for them to then kind of layer back and be able to respond to our universal systems, right? If we make something really neat and snazzy and individualized, then it's hard to fade that back. So I think it's, you know, the purpose really is to identify and provide supports when there is additional need, but before that need is so intense that it needs something individualized or super specialized or really intensive. What else did I leave out, Noah?
No, I was just going to say, so if we take that and we bring it back into like a school setting, right? So we're dosing up our tier one for our tier two. I always like to use check in, check out as a good example of this. It's one of the most well-known tier two interventions that we use for behavioral supports for good reason. But let's say that our building is doing a solid job of implementing tier one supports. We have school-wide expectations that have been clearly defined and taught. And we've got some kiddos that through our data are indicating that they are not yet capable or able to meet those expectations on a daily basis, right? So dosing up of tier one with check in, check out would look like increasing the use of those expectations and providing ongoing feedback to link to that. So if our school-wide expectations are be safe, be respectful, be responsible, I, as the classroom teacher, have tried reminding Danielle that we need to be safe, be respectful, be responsible in the classroom, but a reminder here and there and the initial training wasn't enough. And so we're going to provide more ongoing feedback, right? So we've got those check-ins throughout the course of the day where I can let her know how she's been doing in my classroom, being safe, being respectful, and being responsible during that window of time. And so you're dosing up tier one by providing that ongoing feedback. We've made it more predictable. So she knows that she's going to have these direct interactions with me. There's increased teacher to student connection there. And so we can focus on the positive things that Danielle is doing, not just on the correctives. Billy Joe brought that up earlier. So I can really highlight how she's doing well during those interactions. But that's how you see it kind of play out, is we're not just going, well, Danielle has had problems meeting my expectations within the classroom, so I need a behavior support plan for her immediately. And I need to have my school psychologist come in and do a functional behavior assessment. It's incrementally moving through those tiers and providing the right level of support. Because if we wait until it's behavior support plan time, goodness, Danielle probably struggled for quite a while. She's feeling down about how she's doing in class as the teacher. I'm struggling. But if we use something super efficient, like an intervention that's plug and play like that, we take Billy Joe's public health model and we start to layer on that additional specialist who can check in with Danielle in the morning and check out with her and be really positive, then we start to see those behavioral changes and improvement because she's getting that increased dose of what she needs.
And I think you hit on something really important, which is that it helps us as adults remember to focus on what we want to see, right? That proactive kind of piece that we were talking about a few minutes ago. I remember when I first started working with a school that was doing tier one and didn't really have tier two in place yet. And, you know, when we started layering in check in, check out, guess which kids they were referring for supports? Well, it was those kids who already were on fire. You know, and so we were like, no, 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 you know, we're going to do individualized support planning for them. We want kids who kind of look like this, who have some low level things, they're chronic. And the, I had a teacher tell me once, well, I can handle that student. And what I realized and what the school realized as they implemented tier two over several years was handling becomes nagging. It becomes a negative relationship. It's not skill focused. Usually it's reactive. And so if what we can do is catch those concerns when we're still kind of handling them, but in a reactive way, then we can actually facilitate successful behavior change and hopefully do that before the relationship becomes really damaged between the student and their teachers, or before the student's confidence is so shot that they're not willing to take some risks, right? And, you know, try to be more successful with their behavior. I think about this a lot with like reading interventions too. I know, you know, the academic parallel can be really helpful. If we have students who need additional reading instruction, they typically are still part of whole group instruction, right? And reading doesn't just happen somewhere in a pullout in an intervention group. If I'm struggling, I'm often getting that in addition to, right? And so how do we make sure when we're doing things at tier two, that we are providing students more, right? And then it's clearly linked to our core. If we're talking about social behavior, our PBIS strategy, so it's not something different, just like we would on our reading side, right? Where we try to dose up the literacy pieces in a way that's aligned so that that's happening, you know, across the student's day and not just in this specialized location.
Gotcha. I love your language, Billy Joe, about handling it. I think that's so relatable as teachers, because as teachers, we want to handle it. You don't want to go to someone and say, I need help. Like, it feels good. Like, I can handle this. And yet that's the whole model with PBIS, is to be proactive and be preventative. And I think
You've arrived when those teachers then come to you and say, hey, I think this student would benefit from this. And actually, their data might not even fully show it yet. We're just starting to see some bumps, right? But those same teachers moved from I can handle it to, hey, let's add this additional support. I think the resistance to additional support comes when that additional support is really cumbersome, right? And so I want to handle it either because I feel good about handling it, but usually actually in my experience, the handling it is because if I ask for help, it's going to be a whole bunch of extra things that are hard for me to do as a teacher.
Yeah.
And so right. Trying to make sure that the support we provide is actually a support and not, you know, overwhelming for the educator.
Yeah. And if we were talking about this, what is tier two, and that it's really, it's designed where it can be for a group, like it can be plug and play. It's something that a kid could, let's say today's a Thursday. If my kiddo needed that, they could be on that intervention, like check in, check out by Monday. Like, let's get it going.
Yeah,
let's move. It's a system and it's ready.
Yeah, absolutely. I think point cards have been around forever, just like, you know, tickets have been around forever. But as we know, you know, PBIS is about a whole lot more than tickets. And I think tier two is about a whole lot more than point cards, right? So that system piece of being able to have something that we can quickly put into place that is not too individualized until the data indicate that we need that individualization, that has those opportunities for additional practice and positive feedback, is really important.
Great.
I don't want people to hear that Billy Joe just said we don't want point cards anymore, because as the guy, the resident data nerd, I'm going to tell you,
I love point cards. I'm just saying it's still not the point guard.
No.
The point guard.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure that point didn't get made when it was not intended to, because for every tier two intervention that we implement, I still want to have the data on whether or not we are implementing with fidelity and what the outcomes from that intervention are. Otherwise, we're, you know, driving blind. We don't have the GPS to know where we're going, and we're just hoping that we get to the destination, but could be going north, could be going south. Who knows right now?
Well, let's move into data. So we've got a few questions related to that. So I'll read them, and then Noah, you can jump in first. So first, does every tier two practice come with data to collect, both, like you mentioned, outcome and fidelity? Are there practices you'd consider to be tier two that don't have a data component? And then what are the basic data elements to collect that would help with tier two decision making? So
good questions across the board.
Yes.
So Billy Joe, feel free to kind of chime in as well. So the first question you asked, does every tier two practice come with data to collect? That one, I feel like, is a little bit
loaded.
Yeah. Because if you're asking me, the answer is yes, because I've come up with a data system and a data tracking tool probably for whatever it is that we're going to implement, because again, I heavily value having those data to use for decision making. But unlike check-in, check-out, a lot of what we consider tier two supports, maybe within any given school, might not be something that innately has a built-in data collection tool or tracking system, right? So think about social skills groups, which is a fun, you know, amorphous topic. We get a lot of teachers that are going to tell you that their kid needs social skills groups. But what specifically are we teaching in that group is going to be drastically different based on the needs of the student, because Billy Joe mentioned it earlier, but part of tier two is that the practices are matched to student need, right? So we're not going to put every kid on check in, check out that needs something more. We want to make sure that we have a range of tier two options. And that the decision that we as a team make in terms of which option is going to be the best for our kiddo is A, based on data, and B, matched to student need. And so when we're thinking about, you know, are there fidelity and outcome data for social skills instruction, that has a lot to do with the way that we develop that as an intervention and the way that we implement it and the way that as a system within our school, we actually operate to be able to have data on whether or not students are making progress, whether or not we are implementing the components of the intervention as described, et cetera. And so with Billy Jo says that it's loaded, she is likely indicating that there is something to do with the fact that not everything is going to have all of that built in. But I'll let her speak for herself on that.
Well, I think, again, if we make the parallel to academics, so when we, as we move up the tiers in terms of more intensive supports, we also should be moving up in terms of intensity of all of the aspects, right? So data collection should be a little bit more intensive once we've identified a risk or a need, right? Just like on the public health side, if something's going on, probably going to see some follow-up folks more often than if everything's great, see you in a year. And so I think it's important that we think about what sort of information or data did we use to determine that a student has a need? And so that's one piece, because ideally that's some sort of universal data that we're collecting on all kids, whether that's a screener, whether that's office referral or, you know, teacher reported behavior needs, but something, some sort of information should land us to the place of saying that we need additional support or that a student needs additional support. Once we agree that the student needs additional support, then I think there's two pieces that we want to be looking at in terms of data. One is, how are they looking on those universal type things, right? So again, if we think about academics and we do school-wide screening for third graders, we might be looking at their oral reading fluency score 3 times a year. If we have a student who needs more intensive supports and we figure out, oh, they actually need a little bit of additional help with some early phonics skills, in the real short term, we might be monitoring or getting data on those phonics skills. But we also should be checking in semi-regularly, at least the same pace that we do with other students, to say, how are they doing on their grade level skills in terms of oral reading fluency? And so I think about the same thing with the social behavior piece, which is, so what are the universal school-wide type data sources that we have access to? They could look like attendance, referrals, screeners, and kind of continuing to progress check those. But for most of our students on tier two, they're going to benefit and need something that's a little bit more intensive in terms of data collection. Hopefully not super individualized, hopefully not super time intensive. That's where I think point cards and things like that have become really helpful, because we can monitor more, slightly more targeted skills or in more strategic ways more frequently, and then kind of keep pulse on those school-wide or universal, you know, data points as well.
This is very helpful to me, because I remember when I first came to this work that I asked a question about, like, okay, I know about check-in, check-out. We've got this application that we're doing here. So I'm familiar with the intervention and I get it. There's data. So tell me about the other supports that students could get at this level, and what, how do they all collect data? And it was like, no.
Well, and Megan, you know, one of my challenges too, which is not only collecting the data, but also having a system that makes more efficient use of data, I think is actually the biggest challenge for a lot of our schools. And Noah kind of alluded to that with, you know, he creates those things, but a lot of our schools don't have.
Noah?
Data. Yeah, I know. So they might have some inclination that they should collect data, but if they don't have a system for graphing it, for putting it in efficiently, then that's where it becomes, you know, pretty wild, pretty fast in terms of information may or may not even be collected, because no one's able to use it in a very efficient way. And there's nothing worse than collecting data and doing nothing with it.
Yeah. What's resonating, though, for me is that I had always assumed that the data that we're using at tier two must be related to whatever tier two support you're offering. And what I'm hearing, though, is that it could be that we need to monitor the existing universal thing that we're doing. That can inform whether or not the tier two support we're providing is actually being helpful. Because something, like you were saying, something led us to believe that this particular student or group of students needed some additional level of support. So we should be able to turn to that thing or something similar to that thing to let us know if what the support that we're providing has actually been useful.
Right.
So that's a shift. That's a shift that I hadn't actually considered. Yeah.
And I do think you have to remember that sometimes that thing may not be super sensitive to the skills that you're targeting in your tier two, similar to my literacy example. So it may be something that you look at less frequently, but you're still using that as a way to kind of keep pulse on. But I think that's where the piece and where Noah was talking about that, you know, all of his tier two interventions have data. Probably he's meaning above and beyond because those things are going to be more sensitive to the skills that you're actually targeting to be able to say, yeah, we've still got a gap between where we are and where we want to be, but we're making progress, right? So the where we are and where we want to be is our universal type information. And then our more sensitive data are going to be the things like, you know, our progress monitoring type points that are more closely aligned to the skills we're supporting.
Absolutely. And it allows us to think about, you know, the generalization of the skill that we're teaching. And so if in isolation, I teach Danielle friendship skills, and in our small group, she is able to tell me all the right ways to be a friend within our school, but then goes out to the playground and is shoving Billy Joe to get the sports equipment, right? Then we haven't really planned for generalization. And my data in group might say, man, Danielle is nailing this and it's time for her to exit. But if we're not looking at all of the data as a holistic picture, both from the, are we learning the skill in isolation to, are we able to apply that skill out at recess when I'm going to have an issue with my friend and don't want to shove them, then we need to have the data sources that allow us to see whether or not that student is making the progress we're looking for.
Noah, at the risk of making us all late for our appointments that happen after we record, I'm very curious, because you love data so much, I would just love to hear a little bit about why you value it so much. Mm-hmm. What does it bring to your work, and how have you seen it be so helpful, both at like overall, but especially at tier two?
Yeah. Well, Billy Joe mentioned the tier one side of things and how it's so important to have good data at tier one to help us make decisions about which students are going to benefit from what types of supports at tier two. So before we even get into the tier two set of things, I really want to emphasize having good tier one data really, really does aid in your decision making. And again, going back to the idea that we want to have our interventions match student need. If I put every single kid on check in, check out, just because someone told me that there was a problem going on, that I'm going to be missing the kind of target a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Not every student needs needs that same level of support. So we need various data sources. So Billy Joe mentioned things like office discipline referrals, attendance data, screener data. Those are our kind of common, you know, teacher report, common tier one sources of information that we'd be looking at as a tier two team to screen for and identify students that need those additional support components. At the tier two level, we can't know if the intervention for an individual student isn't working because the data is showing that it's not working if we don't have fidelity data, right? And we might need to look at our all student data as a whole and not just look at one individual student to know if our system is working. And the reason that we want to make sure that we've got good data is it helps us with, you know, are we making good progress for our kiddos individually and as a whole? Are we doing what we said we were going to do and implementing the intervention successfully? Because if we don't have those fidelity data, we don't know if the implementation is actually where we want it to be, then when we don't see outcome data that we're hoping to see, there's a good chance it's just that we didn't actually implement the intervention as it was supposed to be implemented.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think also Noah alluded to this, but being able to, in addition to see what's happening with individual students on an intervention or individual students who need more support if we're looking at moving from tier one to tier two, this also helps us, again, take that step back at the systems level and say, wow, actually, we could do a change that's going to have a more efficient and effective impact on a large group of students, because this isn't actually a Danielle, Megan, Noah, Billy Joe challenge. This is, you know, impacting lots of students. And so I remember working with a fifth grade team of an elementary school, check in, check out, and I was in one of their coaching meeting, coaching them as their PBS coach. And they were grappling with kids who weren't coming to check out at the end of the day. But they were, it was an issue that was coming up on a kid by kid basis. Let's look at Danielle's data. Oh, her data is incomplete. She's not coming down to check out regularly, so we don't actually know how she's doing. And then they talked about other things. And then now here comes Megan. She's also a fifth grader. And so at one point I was like, you know, it's easy for me because I'm the outside coach. I'm not immersed in it quite in the same way the team is. I'm like, what's going on in fifth grade at the end of the day? Well, come to find out, they were all in PE and the kids loved PE. And the end of the day checkout looked like Legos. And so the fifth graders were a little too cool for school in terms of Legos. And so they were would rather stay in PE than come down and check out. And so we made a simple switch to their system, right, of when they checked out fifth graders before PE, and kind of talked about how do we make sure that checkout is reinforcing or, you know, worth it for those kids. But that was a systems change that the data allowed us to identify a gap. And rather than do kid by kid problem solving, which I think when we don't have data, we tend to just sort of throw around why we think that might be happening. We can't find those patterns as easily and identify those tweaks is really important too, to be able to look and say, not just how's it working for this individual, but how is our system impacting, you know, groups of individuals.
That is such a
great thing. As we move in. Yeah. And then as we move into the tier three side of things, like if you think about that continuum of support and that multi-tiered triangle, man, you get so much good data as students move through when you get to the point where you're wanting to create an individualized plan. If you've got good data at tier one and you've got good data at tier two, the development of supports for tier three become a whole lot more efficient and effective because of the information that we already had from our tier two supports.
Absolutely.
Well, we've come to the end, and we usually like to ask our guests, so now what, you know, because we've talked now for a while, and we're at a place where it's like, yeah, I'm on board. I get it. Let's do this. So if you could take just a couple of minutes to offer some advice to some schools about what they would do to get started implementing their tier two systems, data, practices. They've been working on their tier one. It's time to increase and move up into the yellow area and layer on those supports like you were talking about. So what are some of the barriers that they should consider? What are the little things that they could do now just to get started? Where do you recommend they begin?
You want to go first, Noah?
I think he should.
Well, yeah, I was go just giving it. Caution. It's funny because as Megan's asking, the first thing that came to mind was don't do everything all at once.
Right.
And so yeah. I think the really important thing to focus on is to start small and do it well. Right. And so even if that means identifying and I think check in, check out is your low hanging fruit. And it's an easy way to start implementing tier two social behavioral supports. But identify students that are a good fit. Billy Joe emphasized this earlier, right? If we're not doing tier two and tier three in a way that we feel like is effective, don't take the kids that really need highly individualized plans and put them on check in, check out and expect it to work. So you need to identify the right students as you're starting out, but start
and teachers.
Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. Buy-in is huge. And so I brought up the example of the middle school teachers that were not actually checking out with the kid in between periods and not engaging with them on the performance feedback end of things. And so you want teachers that are bought in and ready to, you know, try, because they will likely be your biggest advocates in that building as you're trying to expand out and move this from something that you're doing with one or two kids or three or four kids to a school-wide practice. I think you also need to have administrative buy-in and support, because one of the biggest issues that you run into is if we are making this push and we don't have admin backing it, it's hard to make traction sometimes. And so we want to make sure that we have a cohesive plan at the building level. Ideally, we're making this part of our like building improvement plan, or you know, some of our goals for the building are related to having good supports in place. But start small, start with one intervention, build momentum, and make sure that we're building off of our successes. Mm-hmm. Bill Joe, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I completely agree with the start small. I think we've seen our schools have the most success when they pilot and kind of learn where their individual sort of bumps are and challenges before they've tried to roll out this big, huge mm-hmm. thing. So I completely agree. I also think when you're first doing it, embedding it with your tier one team. And so what I mean is, like, when we initially train on like check in, check out, for example, A, make sure that you're learning not just about the practice, but also the systems and how, and having support in building the systems pieces that are going to sustain the intervention practice components. But I think when we do that initial legwork, instead of having a separate team learning about that or talking about that, it's really, really helpful when the people who have already been invested in your tier one and know what that looks like can be part of those initial trainings and discussions about how do we want to layer on. Once you get it in place, you will probably have a separate smaller sub team or some other combination that's really kind of managing the tier two. But I think that initial push, having that representative buy-in that you have in your tier one team, is really important, because you also will have, you know, your primary teacher saying, well, how's this going to look for kindergarten? And your fifth grade teacher saying, and the person who's on the playground, right? To kind of work through some of those pieces as you're doing those pilots. Those people might also be your best folks to pilot with, right? Because again, they're bought into the tier one work. And so that layering into tier one, I think, is really important. And then two other little thoughts. One is, it's really confusing for people when you try to do something significantly different, but you keep calling it the same thing. So if you have something that has been, you know, let's say check in, check out, for example, and you realize like, oh, we weren't really doing the system of check in, check out, we were just doing point cards, that it's important to either rebrand, rename, or be really clear about, hey, we're revamping. And I think the rebranding aspect is an important piece, even if you also are saying this is, you know, kind of a version of what we did before, because people get really confused when we try to make significant changes from a planning standpoint, but then they're like, oh, we already did that and it didn't work. Totally. So I think that piece is really, you know, another kind of takeaway is be clear about what you're doing and what you call it. And especially if it has a history of being perceived by kids or staff as not being effective, potentially rebranding is really important.
Yep.
And one last thing that came to mind that probably is self-serving because I act as a coach, but seek out coaching support. Yeah. I feel like it's hard for schools, teachers, anyone to know what they don't know. And so when you're first getting started, even if we're starting with something as plug and play as check in, check out, it's really helpful to have a thought partner along the way with you who is had experience supporting schools with that same type of process that can help you contextualize that program to your school's unique needs. And I think that, you know, individualization to schools is a little bit more on the contextualization to schools. We're still doing the same thing. We're just contextualizing it to our specific community, our layout, our environment. And so it's always helpful to seek out and receive coaching support when you're implementing something new, like adding tier two interventions to your building.
We always advocate a coach. Yes. My God, that's why we're talking to the two of you.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Like, yeah, I think that piece is so important. And I think reminding people that tier one's never done. There's nothing as humbling starting tier two to realize the holes that you have in tier one, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, kind of doing those things in tandem is important. And just like we're always going to still need to provide supports for our students who have more intensive needs, but really focusing on that pilot, kind of start small, link it to your tier one, is so critical. And then, yeah, that coach is going to help you make sure that you do what works in your school, but you don't lose the potency in terms of the technical adequacy and the features that really make something work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for being our coaches today. Really appreciate you guys coming. I learn something new, I swear, every time we record an episode, but always. In particular when we talk with coaches who have such experience doing this work out in buildings. The stories that you guys share and the experience you have is so valuable. So thank you for sharing it all with us. Thank you.
So grateful for your time and expertise.